Smith. Maybe a couple of seconds and I will.
Hello, I'm Selwyn Manning and you are watching A View From Afar, and today we are joined by political scientist and former Pentagon analyst Paul Buchanan, and this week we will discuss and respond to elements of the Commission of Inquiry into the Christchurch terror attacks of March 15, 2019. The inquiry's report was released this week. Its terms of reference contain three main areas: the terrorist actions of the public sector agencies, and recommended changes that could prevent future terrorist attacks of this kind. Today's discussion will explore takeouts from the inquiry's report and will consider the cause, the effect, and recommended solutions emerging from the inquiry. But first, here's an invitation to those of you who are joining us live. If you are joining us via Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, feel free to make comments, and if you do, we'll be able to include that interaction in our program. But right now, let's cross to Paul, who is waiting online. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Selwyn.
Well, from a New Zealand perspective, this is a very, very deep and comprehensive report, not just into perhaps the events that took place on March 15, 2019 in Christchurch, but also the operative elements, the challenges and the resource, if you like, of the New Zealand intelligence community and perhaps even those of the Five Eyes. But Paul, I'm really keen to get into this. In the first instance, how do you approach this report and what do you make of it in an introductory sense?
Well, the report was certainly comprehensive. In fact, you might argue that in terms of investigating what led up to the attacks in terms of errors of commission and omission on the part of state security agencies responsible for counterterrorism efforts, this went way beyond that. This went into the terrorist background. Of course, it went into his planning and preparation, but it spent a lot of time on the impact of the attacks on the Muslim community of New Zealand. And a lot of soul searching about warnings that were not heeded. There are entire chapters dedicated to victim testimony and what have you. And they really have nothing to do with the investigation. From someone like me, from my perspective, my thought was, well, that could have waited until we established clearly the chain of causality, again, omission and commission, that led to this atrocious event. But having said that, they've been pretty comprehensive and thorough in investigating pretty all avenues of inquiry. The trouble is this. I mean, again, and I laud them for doing that. Laud them, the Royal Commission, the commissioners themselves. The thing we need to understand, though, I often refer to this investigation, which was scheduled for 6 months and then extended out to 18 months, again, because it was so comprehensive, as being very broad and very shallow. And the broad I've just described, it covered, you know, a multitude of things above and beyond the attack itself and the response of state agencies. But it was shallow in the sense that the commissioners had no powers of compulsion under oath. All witness testimony was voluntary. And I actually testified to the commission myself, and I had the option of taking an oath or not. To me, it didn't matter because I had nothing to offer other than, you know, my opinion about how counterterrorism operations should be conducted. So I had no evidence to give them. But they didn't have the sort of strong coercive powers to make people come in and, you know, fess up if they did something wrong. And then from the beginning, they the terms of reference specified, and this follows the Inquiry Act, so it followed protocol, that no official from the government who became a subject of interest during the course of the investigation would be identified at any time, and their testimony would be suppressed, as it turns out, for 30 years. And the reason for that was that they wanted people to honestly come in voluntarily and say what happened. That, you know, they
I get that point.
But the last, the last part, though, is that you can understand that. I mean, you know, you can see why they would do that. The trouble with that is not just that then it clouds issues of transparency and accountability. But to a very cynical view, that looks like the makings of a whitewash. I don't think it really is. I mean, there may be elements of both.
So you think they balanced it toward the getting down to the tin tacks without the compromising the person's identity within the organization, within the community, and also publicly. And obviously what we're talking about there too, it's actually against the New Zealand law to identify many, you know, apart from the director, if I understand it, relating to the SIS, other you know, people within that frame. Look, so the report, as we said, was released this week, and immediately after that, we had news reports coming out. And I'll just play a clip from Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera, of course, you know, being based up there in Qatar, but also is very prominent within the Muslim communities around the world. And I think its summary, and just I'll just play about a minute of this, is it just frames it very well.
In March last year, this place of worship became a scene of terror. Now it's hoped it can be a symbol of change as Muslim leaders and survivors gathered at the Al Noor Mosque to discuss the findings of an independent report into a terrorist attack.
We've seen the apology from the Prime Minister, from the police, from the intelligence service, which is something good. We started from there, and now we are looking for the change.
After hundreds of interviews and written submissions, the Commission of Inquiry's findings were made public. It found that intelligence and security agencies were too focused on Islamic extremists and didn't pay enough attention to others, including white supremacists like Brenton Tarrant, who carried out the attack on two mosques in Christchurch. And it found police failed to meet required standards when they issued him a firearms license without proper character references or background checks.
While the Commission made no findings that these issues would have stopped the attack, these were failings nonetheless. And for that, on behalf of the government, I apologise.
So, Paul, that's the summary, of course, and that scouts out and scopes for those that aren't perhaps as close to the issue as what we are, and I'm talking about viewers from other parts of the world. With respect to looking at the cause, the effect, and also the solutions, just wanted to frame this, and speaking with you earlier on, we both agree that that's where we'll go with this. We'll look at it from the security intelligence community point of view, and that includes the police and the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service, but also, you know, others are obviously there, the GCSB and others that will be in that frame, but primarily the SIS and New Zealand Police's intelligence units. Now, one of the things that stood out from the report were some of the summaries there, but I'm acknowledging here, Paul, that you've had the privilege of being able to deep dive into this report and give us even deeper insights into it. But first off, we've got a thing here where the inquiry actually states, in the area that is most accessible to most people, and I quote here, the idea that intelligence and security agencies engage in mass surveillance of New Zealanders is a myth. And it goes on to say, in 2014, for example, the intelligence and security agencies were in a fragile state. A rebuilding exercise did not get underway until mid-2016 and was still unfinished when the terrorist attacks took place in 2019. Now, Paul, that's very surprising and very, very concerning for many. Now, just acknowledging, you know, for my part too, that there is a lot of mistrust from many New Zealanders towards our intelligence agencies. There's also a degree of ridicule historically going back to the Penthouse and the Pie episode with respect to security intelligence briefcase being found at a bus stop in Wellington some years ago. But on a more serious note, New Zealanders expect their intelligence agencies, of which to a large degree the population tolerates, to protect them from unseen threats. When we read something like, it doesn't engage in mass surveillance of New Zealanders, I mean, many or that people will think, well, thankfully that's the case. But when we read about the under-resourcing, the political apparatus basically abandoning some of the main signals that are coming in from overseas and certainly within New Zealand relating to terrorist threats not just being from the Islamic community. And this is an issue of major concern. Paul, I really want to speak, hear you speak to those points if you can.
So why don't we do this? let's disaggregate the intelligence community so we understand why these failures were in fact systemic. So in the weeds, at the grassroots level, you have what are known as collection agencies. And that collection can be electronic, it can be human, it can be technological. I mean, you can use satellites and what have you. So you have collection agencies. The foremost here in New Zealand are the Security Intelligence Service, which is a human intelligence service, the GCSB, the Government Communications Security Bureau, which is part of Five Eyes, and that does signals and technical means, and the police, who have their own intelligence shop, which involves both collection and analysis. And that's the second tier. Then there are analytic agencies, which include both of those collection agencies. They do the first cut in-house, if you will. But then they pass it up a chain, and in New Zealand, there are 12. There's this alphabet soup of oversight and coordination and analysis agencies, the foremost in the counterterrorism business being the National Assessments Bureau, which answers to the Prime Minister, and the Combined Threat Assessment Group, CTAG for short. So all of this gets filtered up. And here's what is remarkable is I used to say that right in the immediate aftermath of the attack, I used to say these guys were looking the wrong way. They were, you know, looking for jihadists and so they couldn't see this coming. It turns out they weren't just looking the wrong way. They weren't looking at all. There was this obsessive focus by the intelligence community on jihadists. And part of that, I would say a large part, was due to two things. Not the threat posed by Islamists. At best, they have monitored 30 people a year for the last 10 years, based on what they see on social media or these people's travel plans. But here's what really pushed that. It came from the top. The political leadership, the governments of the day, but also the main opposition politicians, all pushed to counter the Islamist threat to the exclusion of everything else.
And now, just and I'll just you know, for pause there for a moment. I'll just illustrate directly from the report here on what you're saying. In May 2018, there was one project focused on developing an understanding of right-wing extremism in New Zealand. At that time, the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service had only a limited understanding of right-wing extremism in New Zealand, and work on this was not complete when the terrorist attack occurred. And this goes on, one very short sentence there. The intelligence function of New Zealand police also had degraded from 2015 and was not carrying out strategic terrorism threat assessments. That's absolute. That's saying, you're exactly right on that point, Paul, aren't you? You know, they were not.
It's appalling. It's appalling. Now, let me. They also say, though, and again, I'm not here to defend these guys because I'm truly appalled at what I've read.
Yeah.
You not only had the politicians pushing to find, you know, it used to be Reds under the bed, now it's jihadis under the bed. But we've got to remember that politicians control funding.
Yeah.
And funding flows to where they want it to go. So there was no interest in funding efforts to penetrate right-wing extremist groups. They knew they were out there, but they simply stopped looking at them. They discounted
So the government at that time is the John Key-led government, is it?
Was the John Key who, this is the irony, is, you know, National is a right-center government. He made it all about being law and order. He regularly demonized, not Muslims, but Islamists, to the point that he was talking about jihadi brides, that sort of thing. Let me just, for a better context, let's understand this. No Muslim in New Zealand, either before or after 9/11, has been charged, much less convicted, of an ideologically motivated crime of violence. Not a one. So the obsessive focus on would-be jihadis was out of proportion to the threat they represented to New Zealand and its interests.
And even up until mid-2018, it says here the SIS had a lack of capacity until mid-2018 both to deal with its perceived Islamic extremist threat and at the same time to baseline other threats. So it didn't even have enough money basically in resource to actually hit this what was then its primary target.
I mean, it was to the exclusion of everything. Now, mind you, their foreign partners, you know, the United States, the UK, the Australia, they were all pushing to focus on the Islamic threat. And one of the things that emerges from this report is how dependent New Zealand is in the intelligence field on its larger partners. I thought there was a degree of independence and autonomy in making threat assessments. You know, threats that are immediate to us may be, you know, far away for the UK. But it looks like we really, you know, we're downstream, you know, from what they're pushing. And so it washes over us. So the obsession started with our foreign partners, went through our political class, then into the analytic and collection agencies. And what that does is it leads to institutional myopia. You know, now you're just looking at one thing, and let's think about it. They not only excluded right-wing extremists from their threat assessments, they excluded the possibility of environmental activists getting violent. Here in New Zealand, we have some militant Maori folk who believe in Maori sovereignty and whatnot. They may or may not be violent, but they weren't even considering these scenarios because they were so focused on Islamists. And here's where things get really odd. It turns out they use an intelligence model that is, it's based on two things. It is lead driven, that is, they got to get a lead before they act. And it's customer based. So you have to receive leads from the field and then you respond to the demands of your customers. Well, if your customer is the prime minister and he wants to make nice with the United States when it comes to the so-called war on terrorism, of course you're going to have that institutional bias.
Also, I would say here too, and Kevin Hester here raises a good point. If you look here, he's saying to ask Paul what he thinks of the SIS dropping the investigation into the Wellington Trades Hall bombing that killed Ernie Abbott. And he says here on a personal level, his dad went to the grave, went to his grave that the government of Rob Muldoon was involved. So you see coming from the field there, that you know, from the public there, Kevin is representing a real distrust. Also, what he's hitting there historically, one of there's been two prior to the March 15 attacks, there were two major acts of terrorism on New Zealand soil. One of them was orchestrated by the French against the Rainbow Warrior in Auckland Harbour here. Earlier on was believed to be a right-wing attack against the Trades Hall, where the man Ernie Abbott was killed in a bombing in Wellington those decades ago. So you can see that, you know, while environmental groups, while Maori sovereignty and nationalistic groups, particularly those with a left intent, perhaps, or centre-left even, when it comes to shove, seem to have been within the scope of the SIS. That sounds to me it's politically framed, perhaps to appease the particular governments of the day that were overseeing the governance of those agencies. You're seeing evidence of that, or is that too far?
Well, look, it's anathema to intelligence professionalism to choose sides and become partisan in your threat assessments. And I'll point out that this lead-based, customer-based business model that the SIS and apparently the police were operating, there was no room for proactive, over-the-horizon threat assessment. I mean, I was amazed. They simply did not look out over the time horizon and the range of threats that are out there and prioritize amongst them because they were obsessed with Islamists. Truly amazing. But also, and this is, Kevin's point is very good. To Kevin, I'll say this. In the Cold War, communists and socialists were the bad guys. And if they got killed, let's just say that politicians did not cry over their loss. And so a trade unionist guy gets blown up, a bunch of hippies, environmental hippies, have their ship sunk and one of them dies. I can't really see in those days that the intelligence community here in New Zealand really gave a darn. And if Muldoon was involved directly with the trade union hall bombing, one would hope that he'd had some plausible deniability. But I wouldn't be entirely surprised. And of course, we know how reluctant the SIS was to engage the French about that bombing, even though they were pretty well aware from the get-go who did it.
Exactly.
They didn't really want to mess with a larger partner. France is an intelligence-sharing partner of New Zealand's.
Yeah.
So,
and the French embassy in Wellington is actually the largest embassy that France has in the Southern Hemisphere and is believed to collect intelligence on a vast scale with respect to Asia Pacific. Add that point.
I mean, the French have their former colonial possessions down here. They have both a naval fleet and an entire division of land-based ground troops in the South Pacific. So they have strategic interests here. I mean, I don't begrudge them that. But I think, and I saw this after I moved here under the Fifth Labour government and then really got politicized under the key government, that at least the leadership of these intelligence agencies seems to try to skew things towards the preferences of the government of the day. And that's just not on.
So if we pull that and we distill that, what we've got is two factors here that are standing out from what you were talking about. One is a lack of resource and political commitment, and also an agency that potentially could be operating under the flavour of the day that is emitting from the particular people that are occupying the executive government at that time, meaning the politicians in power. So if we get down now into the areas where, with respect to the report, you've gone a lot deeper into the parts of the report than anyone else that I have seen so far, outside of the government apparatus itself. And commend you for that, Paul. With this issue here, could the terrorist have been detected and identified, even considering, those problems of which you've outlined now? There's a part in the report, and it says, given the operational security that the individual maintained, so we're talking the terrorist here, the legislative authorising environment in which the counterterrorism effort operates and the limited capability and capacity of the counterterrorism agencies, there was no plausible way he could have been detected except by chance, is what it says, the report. Paul, what you've gone deeper into this, and I think your response will be more robust than what we have seen so far, emitting from those who have analysed the report in this country so far.
Well, this is their get out of jail card, and that they are claiming that if not a real sophisticated operator, that the dots that they could have connected were too far apart for them to actually make a picture of a terrorist planning and preparing an attack. Now, organizationally, not only have we identified here today some of these major failures, the institutional bias, the business model they operate on, but let's also remember that that framework that I laid out is highly decentralized. And here's where we see more organizational flaws. It turns out that when you're handling classified information, that information and all this alphabet soup of agencies is siloed. So, you know, each agency sees classified information on a need-to-know basis. So you could have a situation, and we did have a situation, where one agency was seeing something, but it wouldn't share that information with other agencies to double and triple check. You know, in other words, that decentralized apparatus with the classification scenes that siloed out information sharing, the SIS, for example, knew of four IP addresses that the killer used. And these IP addresses, they knew that he was buying military style parts for military style weapons, and that these parts were favorites amongst right-wing extremists. They knew this. They knew that an individual from the same IP addresses was accessing the Oslo killer's manifesto and communicating with other bad guys. And yet they couldn't find his name, but in part because they didn't go and ask anyone else. Hey,
you know, just on that point, what stands out, it's absolutely glaring to me, is the legislation that was developed during the John Key-led government years was pulling in all of these government agencies so that it could prevent exactly this type of thing from occurring, to prevent something slipping under the radar that may have been through customs with respect to border control or immigration checks that may go to what kind of countries has this dude been to, blah, blah, blah. Anyone getting flagged out from police intelligence or the SIS or even the GCSB if it has a particular role in such things. So this complete kind of tapestry of intelligence organisations that are supposed to be filtering to a centralised point, you're saying it doesn't occur. And the other thing is what I've read in the report is saying both the SIS, the police and others had no analytical apparatus to make sense of what information was floating around in the mix.
The National Assessments Bureau, which is the highest, you know, analytic intelligence agency, again, directly responsible to the Prime Minister.
Yeah, plugs into the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's the coordinating committee of the entire New Zealand intelligence community. It has a grand total of 30 people, and only one of them, as of 2018, was directed towards counterterrorism. And he or she shared that institutional bias against Islamicists. So, I don't buy this idea that they were completely under-resourced. Now, I haven't crunched the numbers, but I seem to recall that under the Key government, they got two major funding boosts, they being the SIS and the GCSB. And the argument, they also got funding for personnel increases. In the last 15 years, the SIS has gone from a complement of about 230 to about 350. They're more diverse. You know, they do a lot of stuff in Mandarin. But they were getting resource.
That was pointed out by a man called Frank McScasey, who writes on a more left-leaning blog, The Daily Blog, for example. And he's very good on his research, as Frank. And he pointed this out, this element of all resources of it, from the point of view of money component, have certainly increased. So this isn't escaping a lot of people. Yeah, no,
and it shouldn't. I mean, you know, we should ask questions. I mean, the police said that their intelligence capability was completely degraded by 2014, and that's why they gave up trying to monitor right-wing extremists. Now, let's be clear. The police have infiltrated skinhead groups because they're involved in the drug trade. They're major, you know, components of the chain that produces methamphetamine and imports other drugs into this country. So they are aware of the skinheads. They are aware of their ideological tendencies. But they simply did not care to examine them more thoroughly on their propensity for violence for ideological reasons. They chose to look at them as a criminal organization dealing in drugs and cast a blind eye on the ideological stuff, and that turns out to have been a very grave mistake. And so what you're seeing is, yes, you're seeing systemic failures of an order of magnitude that, quite frankly, like I said before, is appalling. I mean, the lack of coordination, the lack of interest, and that is driven by the top. Now, I've heard that, and you can correct me because you're a native-born Kiwi. I just got here 25 years ago. And the reason I say that is because they say, well, look, at the New Zealand public doesn't really care about intelligence matters. Like you say, when they think of the SIS, they think of a bunch of bumbling fools with a pie in a penthouse. And I remember when I first arrived here, having freshly come from the security community in Washington, D.C., I was like, that can't be. You can't be a member of Five Eyes and not be, you know, professional about everything. Well, I'm reading this report and I'm like, the levels of incompetence, you know, the levels of bias are truly astounding. I mean, are truly astounding. And so I think that, you know, even though they've absolved many of the entities and the individuals involved in this fiasco, they've absolved them of guilt. I think that the New Zealand way will be to quietly ask people to retire, to do it all quietly, to not make a big fanfare and you know, shaming exercise out of this. But if they don't, if someone is not held accountable, and I can sort of see that they would rather scapegoat the SIS than the police. Police is a big organization involved in the daily administration of public order. The SIS is a secretive organization, much smaller. So if you're going to start doing scapegoating, the likelihood is it will be with the smaller organization. And by the way, just to talk about one agency that doesn't come out bad here is the GCSB. And it's something that you and I both know, but maybe some of the viewers don't. As a signals agency, the GCSB has to be tasked by another security agency in New Zealand or by its foreign partners when it comes to eavesdropping or other electronic or technological spying in New Zealand. And they were never tasked, never, to go look at right-wingers. We know they've been tasked to go after suspected Islamicists, but in this report it says categorically the GCSB had nothing to do with this. Right. They were completely out of the loop.
On the point of cultural observance as respect to native Kiwis or whatever, everybody that comes to this country, including those that were born here, expects from its intelligence agencies to be operating within the law, within the cultural and moral kind of perimeters of which this country does, but to do its job to make this country safer. The pie incident, the pie in the penthouse and the briefcase is many decades ago now. The imperative elements of it from a Kiwi point of view is do your job. That's why people put up with invasive agencies in this country. Do your job. That includes the police. If you're looking at, before we get into the solutions, many elements of police from on how they go about their business are operational. But there are also elements that are paid for via targeted funding from government. Every budget that comes out around May in each year in New Zealand and Australia will target the New Zealand police to do a particular job and to be seen to be following the policies of which the expectations are mapped out and the calculations of value put across it. To see that that has been dropped is beyond belief. It is, seems to me, without being a overly government person, that targeted funding on such things may be a requirement if the culture within the SIS does not change, if the culture within the New Zealand police does not catch up and meet the brief, then targeted funding is going to have to force. In behind that are the measures of accountability and also oversight and the public's expectation. That one of the comments that came out of the report, that it is summarising that there must be a more public leaning face to the activities of the spy agencies and improved oversight. Now, Paul, we want to talk solutions here. Before we do, I'll just play a part that came across from the Australians yesterday, where a white supremacist activist allegedly has been arrested and is going to be facing charges today. I'll just play that clip now.
To inform you about a New South Wales joint counter-terrorism investigation, we have executed search warrant this morning in Albury, and we've arrested an 18-year-old male. That male we expect will be charged later on today with advocating terrorism and also inciting others to commit acts of violence against the community. The male that we've arrested has an extreme right-wing ideology and is focused on neo-Nazi, white supremacist and anti-Semitic material. For the joint counter-terrorism team, we don't target ideologies. We target criminality and investigate criminality to ensure that we keep the public safe. The arrest today is also consistent with previous comments both Mark and I have said, and our counter-terrorism colleagues around the country, around what we've seen throughout COVID with the move to the online environment and what that has meant for us in terms of our threat environment nationally. The male who...
So, Paul, it continues on into discussing details of the arrest and the characteristics of the individual that has been arrested. Why bring that in at this point? It seems like the Australians perhaps are a number of years ahead of us in being able to detect the operations and the activities of alleged and real white extremist activity, particularly from the social platform areas. It seems it also comes at the cost of liberty. Can you speak to those points from a point of view of solutions, and where do you think New Zealand needs to go from the point of view of the security intelligence apparatus, legislative reform, and the government the overall government response to it?
Yes. I mean, the fact is that not all liberal democracies are equal when balancing civil liberties and security concerns. For example, France is very authoritarian when it comes to any security matter. Draconian, I would argue, and certainly not something that we would ever want to adopt here. The Australians are not as authoritarian as the French, but they are much harder in the security field. And what the commissioner was referring to is they're charging this young man with precursor crimes. That is, he was in the planning and preparation stage. We don't have any laws on the books that allow New Zealand security agencies to do that. And quite frankly, that may be a good thing. You know, you may have to hold off until he makes his move.
So in the case here with respect to March 15 terrorist attack, at what point would an interception to prevent occur? Would it be when he gets in his car down in Dunedin and he's heading north to Christchurch? Or would it be when he is starting to mass his weapons, develop his logistical plan? Or does it come in earlier than that?
I actually can fix a date, December of 2018. That's when he started to go online and speak openly about his plans. He was on 8chan, he was on 4chan, not that I like to mention those outlets, but in December 2018, had the authorities been looking the right way, like monitoring those particular channels.
Then there was just cause to intercede, arrest,
to make a detain. Right, to move against him preemptively. That's well allowed within the law. But, you know, you can't go arrest people for amassing weapons or even saying crazy stuff. I mean, that's protected speech. It's when you put those things together with a clear intent to do harm to others, which this guy in December was stating. And I assume the Australian kid was doing something along those lines, then you make the move. You know, that's quite clear. Now, they're going to suppress the killer's testimony, his evidence, forever.
Yeah, just want to bring a question up on this. This is coming through on John Minto's Facebook thing, but it's from his partner and wife, Bronwyn. And says, what sort of things might be held for 30 years before we can know about them? And also the question, is there any real reason for this other than, I'll just bring it up again, other than their own embarrassment? Thanks, Bronwyn.
Bronwyn, I think this is there's two ways to look at this. I think that, as we said earlier, the official explanation for suppressing all of this evidence and whatnot is to get people to speak honestly in that voluntary setting that was the commission's inquiry. So you couldn't be compelled. So let's say, for just the sake of argument, that there were police officers, undercover police officers, monitoring skinhead gangs because of their involvement in the drug trade, and they knew about the killer. They had heard him talk crazy. They knew about his strange behavior at the gun club, and they just passed on it. They did nothing. Well, they would probably not want to talk if they didn't have guarantees that their names would never be made public. And so I think that the official explanation of, no, this is how you get people to come in voluntarily and be honest about failures and biases and that sort of thing, I think there is, you know, some truth to that. However, an equally fair view is no. This is the makings of a cover-up. This is a making of absolving the guilty from their crimes, in this case, of omission. They simply did not take this stuff seriously. I would have hoped a happy medium could have been met. 30 years means that a lot of these folk are going to be long retired. Many of them will be dead.
Probably like us, will be long gone, you know.
And we'll be long gone. Yeah. So our opinions won't matter.
Some might say, don't be so pessimistic. But, you know, I get your point. The other element here too is, you know, the report, the inquiry, is actually pushing forward this requirement for more oversight, more public-facing considerations, but also debate, dialogue between agencies, media, academics, analysts like yourself, and the public in general. So this 30 kind of year kind of thing kind of erodes into it a little bit from that. But you've given the rationale as to why, and that's something to be considered, I think, very strongly. If we look at the oversight part, before I open the floor to your recommendation, you know, your priority of recommendations and whether or not you think they're feasible. Is this report in its entirety going to create a watershed moment where both the agency's ability is going to be improved, its resources going to be improved and perhaps targeted to get efficiency, and that the New Zealand public is going to be better served, both from the point of view of those that are under surveillance and preventing such things from occurring again, but also from the point of view of satisfying the scepticism, satisfying perhaps the deficits of culture and diversity?
We're in a bit of a watershed moment. And the reason I say that is this report will only be helpful if certain fundamental reforms occur, and those reforms have to be pushed by the public and by their political representatives. I'll give you an example. We had, until recently, a tremendous person as the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, a person by the name of Cheryl Gwynne.
Yeah.
Honest, high integrity, straight shooter.
I agree very much.
She got too close to the bone and asking questions in her oversight capability or capacity as the overseer. She really got too close to the bone, particularly within the SIS. And for her troubles, she was bumped up to become a Supreme Court justice. They took her out of that job. And they've replaced her with someone who is more malleable to the interests of the SIS. On top of that, the current director of the SIS who was brought in as a reformer.
From the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet under John Key. Yep.
And yes, but was brought in to reform the SIS. Yep. And she has become a poster child for what is known as bureaucratic capture, where the agency basically absorbs you and turns you into the beast that you were supposed to tame. And so she said, for example, when this report came out, that the SIS did not monitor the Muslim community. Now, what she meant, I think, was that we do not monitor Muslims as a community, but it is laughable to say that the Muslim community of New Zealand was not heavily monitored by the SIS for years after 9/11.
And I can underscore that myself, and from the point of view of media and documentary making and things like that, of having an individual which was very deeply planted inside, and I can name the mosques if they wish, and I can give I can actually provide them with audio and video files of that surveillance. It's an extraordinary comment.
Well, they got copies of your stuff anyway.
Yeah. It's an extraordinary comment for the director of the SIS to make.
Yeah.
Fudging at best.
Here's the trouble. We get this report, and it's this tremendous moment of opportunity to say, look at you guys, you were looking the wrong way because your prejudice got the best of you. And we know about this syndrome known as institutional lag, where intelligence agencies are always fighting against the last enemy and not looking forward. We know that. But this offers us an opportunity in the wake of the most heinous terrorist event in New Zealand's history to reform the agencies responsible, among other things. For example, that decentralized, leads-based, customer base, get rid of that. Let's reform this smorgasbord of collection and analytic agencies into a more cohesive whole where information is shared amongst them rather than held in turf battles that make no sense given the levels of threat that we see. I'm not sure that moment will arrive if we have people like a complacent Inspector General of Intelligence Security and a bureaucratically captured director of the SIS. I just don't see it happening. So it's incumbent upon us as the public, it's incumbent upon the politicians who represent us to demand some hard questions and hard answers of these guys. And it may mean that some people have to go.
That's something that the minister responsible beyond the Prime Minister, Andrew Little here, seems like he wasn't firming up on that people had to go, that he made the comment on Radio New Zealand's checkpoint on the day of the release of the report, that he was quite satisfied with the people that were representing the agencies. One of the things here is, from the recommendations, I'm very interested in this, is the creation of a national intelligence and security agency, and I just put in the letters there. Let's call it NISA, NISA, for argument's sake. This will deliver a more systematic approach to counterterrorism and countering violent extremism efforts. The CEO of a proposed NISA would be the National Advisor on Intelligence and Security. Full implementation of our recommendations, this is the inquiry saying this, will result in a better organised counterterrorism effort with enhanced capability and capacity and less restrictive legislative framework. So what we're talking about here is like a bolt-on at the top, if I'm reading this right. It's an agency of which everything will feed into, that the SIS's inabilities to analyse and its degradation of its analytical kind of processes at that stage, and perhaps put across to the NAB, the National Assessments Bureau, when it morphed from the External Assessments Bureau into that name without resource, etc., and was traditionally underfunded and not regarded even by prime ministers in the past. So this new agency would be the catch-all analytical body, and one would imagine that interfaces with not just executive government and the various ministers, but also the parliament. And one would hope, perhaps, an opportunity for oversight framework being attached to that as well, if we take the spirit of which this inquiry report is written. What are your comments on that?
Well, we don't need another bureaucratic layer, and we certainly don't need looser legislation when it comes to controlling the spies. What we need is a complete overhaul where that alphabet soup of agencies are brought under one roof. And you have to think about it this way. Immigration has an intelligence shop. Customs has an intelligence shop. The Ministry of Business and Enterprise has an intelligence shop. Everybody's got an intelligence shop. It would be better to have them housed under in the same agency as branches of these main offices, but where they're inside a community of people who are sharing information, you know, looking at the threat landscape, and you know, there's differences of opinions within intelligence community.
Could that be this NISA, this National Intelligence and
Security? It could be. Again, I haven't seen the details. It could be. I personally think they need to strip out some of these agencies. There's, for example, a Security and Intelligence Coordinating Committee. What the hell do these guys do?
Exactly.
If the report comes out, they were clueless.
My understanding was that they were supposed to be at the coalface of pulling in all of this information and making sense of it.
There seems to be a lot of make work for well-connected individuals in parts of the New Zealand intelligence community. And I don't want to cast aspersions on the hard-working coalface miners. But one thing that comes out is this coordinating committee, they didn't do anything. I mean, nothing. They just sort of parroted the line of the day. And, you know, these people are drawing salaries and whatnot. There are several agencies like that that, quite frankly, from my point of view, have no reason to exist, have no reason whatsoever. So a streamlined apparatus, again, with no legislative license. They got plenty of license as it is. This was a problem, not so much of resourcing and legislative fiat as it was institutional bias. You know, again, one that ran right into the political class and was shared by our partners. If we can remedy that with organizational reform that centralizes the collection and analytic abilities and then passes it up to the highest echelons of the government in a more streamlined fashion, then I think we'll get better real-time threat assessments so long as they're objective. If we still have people in high places who cater to the government of the day, and whatever whims those may be, then that lack of intelligence professionalism will yet again come back to bite us in the rear down the road.
On that point, Paul, thank you very much for your efforts in the last week in going through this report, and also for being on the program once again, A View from Afar, in this episode of December 10, 2020. Paul, I look forward to us engaging on such issues in the future, and I look forward to people's company with The View from Afar, and you see it being pushed around the place, and certainly from a live point of view, those comments coming in are certainly welcome. Thank you, and goodbye.